It occurred to me that a paper topic which I don't remember if I listed but would be interesting to do would be the whole Google Books controversy. That is Google's attempt to, in effect, get the law changed via court action so that they can web a whole lot of books. Where in particular, I mean, in a sense, the real question is the default rule that if you don't say they can't, they can, or is the default rule if you don't say they can, they can't? And I think under current copyright law, it's reasonably clear that the default rule is that they can't web my book unless I tell them that they can. And the argument is there are a whole lot of books out there which are long out of print, where it's hard, maybe impossible to find the copyright holder, but even if you can, it isn't worth spending $5,000 searching down the copyright holder and getting his permission in order to web a book that's going to bring in $100 worth of advertising. So Google's potential argument is that you would be better off if you have some version of default rule is they have permission to web it unless you tell them not to. They then owe you some prearranged share of any revenue they get, assuming you show up at some point, and so forth. And that's the kind of settlement they did. I have not followed the details of it. But it just occurred to me, if anybody hadn't found a paper topic yet, that would be a fun one to explore. All right. Subject for today is the Kosian account of how you deal with externalities. And as usual, let me start by seeing whether you have questions about that subject. Are there things in the peace of mind that you read which didn't make sense to you? Yes?
There's always like a personal, a human victim. Whether it's the, you know, the business owner of the land owner, why can't the victim just be Mother Nature? And I know that's possible.
I guess the answer is that the victim could be Mother Nature, but if no human being cares about it, it is hard to see it's ever going to get into the legal system. That is certainly, Coase is thinking in terms of human values and humans interacting with each other. That's clearly the context. And I agree that one interesting sort of philosophical issue is, does that cover everything it ought to cover? And you might say, many people would say they feel that animals have rights, or if animals don't have rights, that at least the happiness of animals should go into the proper moral calculus. And some people would go beyond that. They would say that even if nobody is ever going to see the Mona Lisa again, it would be a bad thing for it to be destroyed, that its very existence is a value. And similarly, somebody might say, if there is a species which is of no value at all to humanity, it is still a bad thing for it to vanish. And that one of the things I think one can observe if you watch arguments about environmentalism is the degree to which claims about effects on humans are really bogus in the sense that what's really motivating the argument is something else. And I can even see that in myself, that my backyard has in it a large live oak tree, which was there when we moved in. I wish it weren't there. I like planting fruit trees. I've got a lot of fruit trees. That thing is shading areas where I could plant more fruit trees. If a stroke of lightning destroyed that tree, I would be a happy man. But I have not cut it down or hired anybody else to cut it down, because it's a big, loving, living thing, and it sort of feels wrong to me. Not infinitely wrong. Obviously, I cut it down for a good enough reason. It's not that I object to, you know, cutting down lumber. But on the whole, it seems like it's of some value, as it were, for this thing to be there, and that makes me reluctant to remove it. So I can see in my own, if I try to engage in introspection of my own values, that there are some things other than usefulness to humans that come in. But it's hard to see how anything other than value to humans is going to come into a human legal system, because somebody, whether you're thinking about a political system where someone is lobbying to get something, or a legal system where someone is suing, or an economic system where somebody is paying for something, all of the players are human beings, and therefore it's hard to see. What?
I guess it goes to the issue of whether trees have standing.
Trees stand up, but they don't have standing in a court, because they yell. Let me go back a step. You could imagine, suppose you had a legal system which said that trees have standing and that people can sue on their behalf And if you sue on the tree's behalf and win, just as in a class action, you can persuade the judge that you should get awarded some part of the judgment damage to pay your legal fees, and that gives you an incentive to do it, a bounty system, which exists in lots of parts of the law, after all. Now, I'm not sure how the money gets spent, but maybe you could say, well, if you win the case, then the defendant has got to plant a certain number of trees of the sort that was destroyed. So I don't want to go so far as to say it would be impossible, but it would only happen if there were human beings who valued, who either had moral beliefs that were offended by cutting down trees or some other value, and therefore were willing to lobby the legislature to make such a law, or to persuade judges to read such a law into the Constitution or something. There's lots of ways it could happen. So it is an interesting, I don't think it has a whole lot to do with Coase, but it is an interesting general question to think about whether confining legal issues to, in effect, costs and benefits to human beings really is right. And certainly, even in the way we look at the legal system, there are some intuitions that go beyond that. Because if you go back to the discussion we were having, I think last class or the class before, no, I'm wrong. It's a discussion in my other class. We were having a class about the question of the distinction between criminal law and civil law, criminal law and tort law. Because one of my favorite speech topics is, should we abolish the criminal law? The argument being that you could have a legal system in which all criminal law was replaced by something like tort law. And there have been such legal systems, that if you killed somebody in Iceland in 970 AD, his relatives sued you. There wasn't an equivalent of our criminal system. So one of the answers you get is that criminal law is supposed to punish moral wickedness. And if that's right, that somehow suggests that you would want to punish moral wickedness even if it did no harm. All right? This goes to a puzzle that I've often thought was sort of a fun puzzle, which is the distinction between attempted murder and murder. And it's a double puzzle. From one standpoint, the question is, why do you punish attempted murder at all? I shot at you, I missed and hit a tree. You're fine, the tree is fine. What's the problem? And yet we do punish it, and partly we feel as though it's justified. I can make law and econ deterrence arguments for doing it, but putting that aside, if you ask why, what people's gut feeling is, part of it is that I was an evil person for doing that. It should be punished. The flip side is, why do we punish successful murder more severely than attempted murder? Because after all, being a bad shot is not a moral virtue. So why do I get off just so I happen to miss? So those are both interesting questions which I think come out of what you're saying. I don't think any of that have much to do with our subject today, but picking about interesting things is worth doing. All right. Questions on Coase? Nobody. Yes. All right. I can sort of start running through stuff in covering things, not all of which are in the article, and get stopped, hopefully, when people think there are things that need to be explained. And we start out with the basic problem of externalities, and it's really, let me go back a step. The term market failure is one of these unfortunate terms that sounds self-explanatory and isn't. And that happens in a lot of technical fields. I am sure that the world is full of people who think they understand the theory of relativity except for the mathematical details. Theory of relativity, that says everything is relative, I understand that. But of course, that's not what the theory of relativity says. Similarly, the term market failure sounds as though it means markets failing. And that's really wrong in two different directions. Not all ways in which markets can fail count as market failure, and not all market failure involves what we normally think of as markets. All right, let me see if I can expand on that a little bit. Suppose that the market failure consists of not producing a cure for AIDS. All right. Suppose that there is, in fact, some chemical compound that, if we knew about it, would cure AIDS. Doesn't appear. Well, the market has failed to do something we'd like it to do. But that doesn't count as what we consider market failure. Why? Because what market failure means to an economist, certainly the way I use it, and I think the way many other people use it, is the failure of individual rationality to lead to group rationality. All right. Let me put it in that. I think that's the easiest, most general way of thinking about it. And the I'll give you my favorite example, nice dramatic example. It's 1,000 years ago. You are one of a line of 10,000 men with spears. Your spears are pointing that way. Why are they pointing that way? Because a similar number of men on horseback with spears are coming at you. And you do a very quick cost-benefit calculation. And you say, if we all stand and keep our spears pointed, with luck we will break their charge. Some of us will die, but most of us will live. If we run away, horses run faster than we do. I should stand. I made a mistake. I said we. I don't control him and him. If everybody else runs and I stand, I'm dead. If everybody else runs, my only chance is to hope I can run faster. If everybody else stands and I run, there are 10,000 people in this line. Losing one guy is going to have very little effect on the chance of stopping their charge. So therefore, if everybody else stands and I run, I very, very slightly increase the chance of losing, but I greatly decrease the chance of my getting killed. So therefore, the rational, self-interested thing for me to do is to run. Everybody in the line makes the same calculation, and most of us die. Welcome to the dark side of rationality. All right? For those who are familiar with this, this is just a multiplayer version of the prisoner's dilemma. The prisoner's dilemma, which some of you have probably encountered and some of you haven't, is the two-person version of a situation where individual rationality doesn't lead to group rationality. All right? And that, I think, conceptually, is what economists really mean by market failure. Well, in the case of AIDS, nobody knew the chemical involved. I am assuming that there was no obvious research to do that would have found it. Each person acted rationally, and the group acted rationally, in the sense that if you imagine somebody who had all the knowledge of the group and was saying, what should we do? He still wouldn't have done it, because they don't know how to do it. On the other hand, my army running away really is market failure, because that really is a case in which we would all be better off if we did something else. We all know we'd all be better off if we did something else, and yet it's not in our individual interest to do it, and so we don't. All right? Makes sense? It's a way of thinking about the world, because I think it's a fairly powerful way of thinking about the world. And it's a way that applies way beyond markets. For example, you could plausibly argue that the reason democracy doesn't work is market failure. What do I mean by that? What's the simple theory for why democracy ought to work? The theory is the government, the people running the government have to do good things, so if they don't, we'll vote them out. All right? That's what I think of as a civics class model of democracy. In order for that to work, however, the voters have to know whether the people doing things are doing good things. That's not a trivial problem. First, you have to know what they're doing, which isn't always obvious if you think about how complicated a modern government is. Second, you ought to know what they ought to be doing, which isn't obvious. And then the question is, you as a voter, what is your incentive to be well-informed in order to be able to do that? You know, suppose you say, yes, if I spent a lot of time and effort studying government and stuff, I could figure out whether to vote for or against the Democratic candidate in the next election, say. What do I get for that? Well, if I spend all that information, then it is more likely that I'll vote correctly, that I'll vote for the good guy. One more vote for the good guy has maybe one chance in 5 million of changing the outcome in a presidential election, somewhere around there, if you think about how large the back and forth swing in a presidential election is. So how large a payment am I willing to make in order to improve the chance of getting a better president by 1 in 5 million? Very, very, very little. All right? So from the standpoint of each individual voter, it is rational to be ignorant. This is what's referred to in public choice theory, which is economics applied to government, as rational ignorance. It's the interest of each individual voter to be rationally ignorant. The result is that the civics class model breaks down. There may be other models for making democracy work, but you cannot, in fact, rely on well-informed voters voting out the bad guys. I'm curious, how many of you, I'm only interested for a moment in U.S. citizens, how many of you know the name of your congressman? The person who represents you in the federal House of Representatives. House Rep. All right. How many don't? Right. All right. I don't either. I should have raised my hand. I'm not sure who it is at the moment. Why should I? You know, you might have a hobby of following politics. It might be fun to follow politics. Or you might be somebody for whom it's important because you're in a business which is regulated by the federal government, and you figure if you make appropriate campaign contributions, your representative will talk to the regulatory agency in your favor. You can think of various reasons why particular people need to know. But in general, that's market failure. All right? It's just as much market failure as the army running away or the sort of standard example, which is something like air pollution. All right, air pollution is just like the army running away. Each individual, you're living in London in 1870 or something, and everybody knows that the thick fogs in London are a real pain, and maybe they're even dangerous. And why do they occur? Because everybody's burning coal in their fireplaces to keep warm. And you say, well, maybe I shouldn't burn coal in my fireplace. What will that do? it'll reduce the fog by, you know, a millionth or something, and I'll be cold. Doesn't make any sense to do it. So, therefore, rationally, each person does it, even though they might. In that case, I don't know if there was a better alternative, but maybe there was a cleaner fuel. I'm not sure there was. But it wouldn't make sense for the individual to prevent the fog, even if it were the case that the cost of preventing is lower than the damage it does. Do you have a question?
Yeah. Is there a kind of tipping point effect as well? So in the Army example, if just five people run, the chances of those five people having improved their chance of surviving if the horses are going to run them down.
No, but if just five people run them, then with any luck, the horses won't run them down because the other people are going to stop the charge. So I think in that case, I don't think there is a tipping point. I think however many are going to run, if they're all going to run, well, if you run a little bit faster, you might get away while the attackers are killing your buddies, right? And on the other hand, if the other guys are going to stand. No, going to be more realistic, the real solution to that is that you hang the guy who runs. The real solution in real military, I like to say that one solution to that problem is proverbial, namely burning the bridges behind you. All right, you march your army across a bridge, you burn the bridge, and you then say to your troops, all right, guys, no place to run, do we better stand? And that works some of the time and has really bad consequences when it fails. All right, what are other solutions? Another solution is that you modify the objectives of your people. You persuade people in some way that they care a whole lot, either about being brave, or about their side winning, or about their buddies not being killed. My favorite story for this is the Sacred Band of Thebes. I don't know how many people are, probably nobody. Nobody studies ancient history. The Sacred Band was a military unit made up of pairs of homosexual lovers. No one of which would ever abandon his beloved or show cowardice in the presence of his beloved. And they won every battle they fought in until the last, when they encountered an army commanded by Philip of Macedon and his son Alexander, later to be known as Alexander the Great, and died to a man. That at least is what we're told. We have to check these things historically. All right? So, but that's a solution. All right? There are other solutions. When we see descriptions of the American Revolution, for those of us who are Americans, we sometimes make fun of the silly British who dressed their soldiers up in bright scarlet uniforms with lots of buttons so as to make it easier for us to snipe at them from the hedgerows and things and march them around in neat formations. This is the same army that beat Napoleon not very long before that, right? No, actually not long, very long after that, I'm wrong. Just after, a little bit after that. What's going on? What's going on is that bright scarlet uniform with lots of buttons makes it real hard to vanish into the undergrowth when your side is losing. Marching in neat formation makes it hard to retreat to advance to the rear without anybody noticing. So almost certainly, I think, I'm not an expert in this, the things the British were doing at that time were perfectly sensible ways, not of fighting the enemy, but of fighting their own people. That is, of controlling the incentives of their own soldiers to do things that result in losing battles. Anybody know in modern warfare, and I'm really thinking of very modern, because I don't have the data, but say World War II, World War I, what the ratio is of bullets fired to people killed? Yeah? That's right. It's more than 1,000 to 1. It might well be more than 10,000. Well, you're in a foxhole. And there are other guys in foxholes along the way. And what you're supposed to do is to stick your head out and watch for an enemy and shoot him. That's a very dangerous thing to do. But on the other hand, if you do this instead, the lieutenant 3 foxholes down doesn't know whether or not you're doing the job. Besides, he's probably doing the same thing. With luck, you're making the enemy keep their heads down so they aren't shooting at you as much, and you're much less likely to get killed. So that might be market failure in the battlefield. I don't know, but you can at least imagine a case where if all the soldiers stuck their head out and watched for the enemy and shot them whenever they stuck their head out, you'd win, but each soldier would be worse off as a result. So all of these are the problem of market failure. Now, Coase ultimately is explaining where market failure comes from, and he's offering a different explanation than the standard explanation it wasn't put in that language, but it was accepted prior to him. And the particular example that runs through his work and most of the discussion is the particular form of market failure called externalities. But really, you can put most forms of market failure into that language. Or when we say an externality, what is that? That's a case where my action imposes a cost or gives a benefit to you under circumstances outside of the normal property transaction, where if I want to cost you, I got to get your permission. If I give you a benefit, I can charge you for it and so forth. So you could say that any time that I use an hour of someone's labor, that's a cost to him, but I got to pay him wages to make him willing to do it. So I include that cost. But anytime I put out a puff of smoke from my smokestack, that might be a cost to people downwind, but it's a cost that, absent any special legal arrangements, I don't bear, therefore I ignore that cost. So going back to the point that I've made in the context of IP repeatedly, but it's important more generally, if you want people to do things worth doing, one obvious strategy is to set things up so they get the benefit and bear the cost. And then if total benefit is larger than total cost, they'll do it. And then there's a net gain to their doing it. If it's less, they won't do it. Right. Nice, simple strategy. It gets much more complicated when you try to apply it, but at least it's a useful starting point. Well, in the case of externalities, if my making steel, I pay for the labor, I pay for the ore, I pay for the coal, but I don't pay for the air pollution that is making things unpleasant downwind. All right? Therefore, I, as an individual producer of steel, say, how much does it cost me to produce a ton of steel? It costs me $123. If I can get paid at least $123 for a ton of steel, I'll produce it. If not, I won't. That's the basic logic of how that works. And you, as a user of steel, say, what does it cost? Now, if there are lots of steel producers who can all produce at $123 a ton, they're going to compete the price down to $123 a ton, because if one of them tries to charge $140, someone else will charge $139, and so forth. So now I, as a user of steel, say, if the benefit to me of using steel is more than $123 a ton, I should use steel. If not, I shouldn't. All right, nice, simple argument. Perfect system. The price I'm paying is signaling to me the cost to all of the people who are providing the inputs. And then I am bearing that cost. I'm using the steel to make automobiles, which I sell to people, so I get the value of the automobile to them in reply. Looks like a perfect system, except we left out the air pollution. Because the real cost of producing steel is $140 a ton after you put in $17 a ton. That just embedded for the cost the air pollution imposes. So now, anybody who values the steel at more than 123 and less than 140 is using it and shouldn't be. All right, is that argument reasonably clear? Yeah, no? That's from an economist, in a way, that's an inefficient result. He's making the whole society on net poorer and not richer once you include all the costs, including the cost of the evolution. So that's the basic problem. It works for positive externalities, too. Right. Suppose that what I am running is not a steel factory, but a bakery. And, oh, it's so nice to live close to that bakery because you get the wonderful smell of fresh baked bread in the morning, and it just makes your beans and rice that you being a poor working woman so much better when you can smell the wonderful smell. Some of you cinnamon bread. It's just wonderful. The almonds in it. So therefore, the bakery is producing a positive externality. He's making people better off. He can't charge for that externality. So suppose things aren't going very well, and it turns out that the cost of running the bakery is $1,000 a month, and the income from running the bakery is $999 a month. Well, if he expects that situation to continue, he just found the bakery. But when he's doing that, he's eliminating a $100 a month benefit that the people living near him were getting by smelling his bread and stuff. So therefore, his shutting down the bakery makes the society as a whole $99 a month worse off, not better off. All right. So that's the case of a positive externality. So the negative externality means you have an incentive to do things that ought not to be done ultimately, and the positive externality means you have too weak an incentive to do things and therefore don't do some things that should be done. Second problem, or the first problem, sort of first order result of the externality is that your incentive for whatever to do whatever you're doing that produces the externality is wrong. Is you have too much incentive to do it if it's negative, too little if it's positive. Second is that you have no incentive to reduce the external cost or increase the external benefit. So I imagine that I am running that steel mill. It could be that I could reduce the pollution costs from $17 per ton of steel produced down to $5 per ton of steel produced. I could use low sulfur coal, or I could have high smokestacks so that more of the effect dissipates before it reaches humans. I could locate my steel mill in an area where there was nobody downwind. That would solve the problem. You can think of a variety of ways in which I might be able to modify what I'm doing. If you think about the externality issue with global warming that people argue about a lot in the last few years, I could choose to use natural gas instead of coal because natural gas produces less CO2 per power generated than coal does. So I can think of lots of ways I could do it. But if I'm not bearing the cost of the externality, why should I bother? So as long as I'm not bearing the cost of the pollution from my steel mill, it would make sense for me to say I will only put up the higher chimney if I get some benefit from it. Otherwise, it's just money down the drain. Why should I care about other people? Let me talk about other people. So that's the problem. And you can think of the positive externality similarly. That the positive externality, the bake shop owner really ought to have located his bake shop wherever he had the most neighbors to get the pleasure of smelling his good bread. But maybe the rents were a little higher there, so he located it out in the countryside, and only the cows get to benefit from it. So you can run through that in any of those cases. So that's the basic issue. Right? And the solution to this problem that was accepted by everybody in the small world of economists, I'm reminded somewhere I picked up a quote from somebody who was talking, I don't remember the quote actually, but it was someone, a paleontologist talking about early man, and it was something about, you know, as everybody knows, the period from, you know, 1 million to 1,200,000 was when something was happening. And of course, everybody knows it means 17 people, but they're the only people he talks to because they're the people in his field. Similarly, when I say everyone, I mean all academic economists, basically. So all academic economists knew that the solution to the externality problem was the one that Pigou had proposed. And Pigou's solution was what we call a Pigouvian tax, alias an effluent fee, namely when I produce pollution that costs $17 per ton of steel, for people downwind, I've got to pay a fine of $17 for each ton of steel's worth of pollution. And that's Pigou's solution. Now, that's not the only possible solution. The solution all the non-economists were in favor of, and many of them still are, unfortunately, is direct regulation. So the non-economist solution is to say, all right, we have concluded that building a tall smokestack costs you less than it saves us in air pollution, so we will require steel mill steps to all smokestacks. We have concluded that any way you run your steel mill inside the boundaries of Santa Clara County, the pollution cost is too high to make it worth doing, so we will ban steel mills within Santa Clara County. You'll have to take it out somewhere where there are people who are bothered. You can think of lots of examples of direct regulation of various. And there are basically three problems with direct regulation. The first is you have to know what the damage is done by the externality in order to know when it is or isn't worth having it. Second, you have to know the cost of preventing it. All right, you can prevent the pollution from my steel mill in two different ways. One of them is not to produce steel. I produce less steel. And one of them is to do things like high smokestacks or scrubbers or low sulfur coal that reduces the amount of pollution produced. In order for the regulator to give the right orders to the firm that's being regulated, it has to know what's the least expensive way of solving the problem and whether the least expensive way of solving the problem costs less than the benefit of solving the problem. We don't want to solve all problems. The term pollution is a very loaded term. I think it originally comes out of a religious context. And it sounds as though pollution is automatically bad. But it's not necessarily worse than not pollution if not pollution means not doing something you really want to do. Right? There are always trade-offs in everything. I like to exhale, for example. If I only inhale and don't exhale, there are problems. My exhaling results in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that maybe creates global warming. And then there's a third problem with the regulatory solution, which only really started becoming clearly recognized in economic literature, I think, as a result of the work that Jim Buchanan got into Nobel Prize for, and also some of Stigler's work on economics of regulation and economics of politics, and that is, why do we assume the regulator is going to be trying to do the right things? That is to say, what are the, we've talked about the incentives of the steel mill, but what about the incentives of the regulator? That the regulator, why do we assume that the regulator has a reason to say what is the optimal regulation for controlling this pollution? I've just discussed why the civics class model of democracy doesn't work, so that isn't an explanation. And why wouldn't the regulator instead say, aha, firms really like to not be required to have high smokestacks. So that means that I can be very generous to these firms and have very easy regulations for them to follow. And when I retire from being a regulator, I will get a nice job with one of these firms, or maybe with the industry organization of these firms, twiddling my thumb and being paid a good salary as a reward for treating them well. That's one thing I might do. What are other things I might do as a regulator? Well, I might say, my boss is the president. This set of firms gave almost no donation to the president when he was running for president, so therefore we should really clamp down on them and make sure they're not polluting at all. They're obviously bad people. Whereas those firms, those are good public-spirited firms that gave us lots of money, we will be understanding for them. So you can see a lot of different ways in which the incentives might play out in the regulation. And in fact, part of what happened with the sort of new economic theory of regulation that Stigler was partly responsible for was recognizing that quite often the regulators are in fact the allies of the firms. That what they're doing with their regulation is not actually controlling problems, they're holding down competition. That is to say, they are saying that, for instance, under airline regulation, it was illegal for an airline to cut its fares without permission from the Civil Aeronautics Board. And when an airline asked for permission, all the other airlines flying that route would explain why they shouldn't be allowed to do it. All right. To take a perhaps more important example, under the system of medical licensing, which existed a long time ago and still exists, you can't practice medicine without a license. During the 5 years, I think, after Hitler came into power in Germany, the number of foreign physicians admitted to practice in the U.S. was about the same as in the previous 5 years. The number of doctors who wished to leave Germany at the time, I can assure you, was a great deal higher. But there were various restrictions on people who had foreign degrees being allowed to practice in the U.S., which kept down the number. During the Great Depression, the American Medical Association sent a letter to all of the medical schools telling them that it thought they were really training more physicians than they could properly train. And all the physicians cut down on their admissions, which meant, of course, fewer doctors, which meant higher wages for doctors. Why was that the case? Because the states got their list of approved medical schools from the Council on Medical Education and Hospitals at the AMA. And being removed from that list meant you were very largely out of business because now your graduates were unlikely to get approved unless you were the state medical school and they were only going to practice in that state, basically, as a situation. So you can think of lots of problems with the regulatory solution. And that's one reason why economists, once they started thinking about those things, said, aha, Pigou's got this great solution. It's true that with the Pigouvian solution, we have to figure out the damage done. And that has some problem, and you have got to worry a bit about corruption in doing that. But figuring out how much damage is done by sulfur dioxide, A, once you figure it out, it's going to apply to lots of different firms, so it's going to be hard to favor particular firms over others. And at least it's an easier problem than figuring out both how much damage is done and how it should be controlled. Because once you have the Pigouvian tax, you've now passed on the problem of how to control your externality to the firm. Because the steel mill says, all right, we know that if we pollute, if we produce steel in the way we're doing it, we're going to be paying an extra $17 a ton as the fine for the Pigouvian tax for our air pollution. Since we're doing that, well, there are a couple of possibilities. One of them is that we should keep producing steel the way we're doing it and raise our price by $17, otherwise we're losing money. Everybody else is in the same situation, so the market price goes up $17, and now people only use steel if it's worth $140 a ton, not $123 a ton, because that's the new price. That's one answer. And you're then reducing the amount of pollution by reducing the amount of steel produced. This price is going up. Alternatively, we might say, well, you know, we could eliminate that pollution entirely if we, I don't know what they're going to do, but if we have scrubbers and smokestacks, we can do that at $8 a ton. Wonderful. $9 a ton savings. If our competitors don't do it, we're going to be able to make an extra profit because their price will be higher. If they do it, at least we won't lose out. So the beauty of the Pigouvian tax is that it transfers the part of the problem that the firm is best qualified to solve, namely figuring out how it can adjust its behavior to the firm, and the part of the problem that the rest of the market is best qualified to solve, namely deciding how much steel is worth, to the rest of the market, because if they can't reduce the pollution, the price goes up, and then everybody else has an incentive to use less steel. Very elegant solution. And as of about 1960, everybody agreed. And then Coase writes an article, and he comes to the University of Chicago, and he's going to give a workshop on the article, and he has dinner at the house of Aaron Director, who was the first editor of the Journal of Law and Economics. And the beginning of that dinner, as we were told, I think, by Stigler, the vote was 14-1 against Coase. That is to say, Coase said Pigou is wrong, and everybody else said, no, Pigou is right. And at the end of the dinner, it was 15-0 for Coase. So that's sort of the famous story in my field, as it were. And what's Coase's argument? And I sketched out the way I put the argument. It's not the way, if you want to, you can probably find the problem of social cost, which is the Coase-Mean article, on the web. It does not have a lot of mathematics. It does not have a lot of stuff that's inaccessible. It's not all that easy because he discusses a bunch of stuff, which is one reason I wrote my article. But it is something you can read and you might find it fun to read because it's probably the most cited article in the field of economic analysis of law and probably one of the most cited articles in economics, modern articles in economics at all. It's a neat article. But in any case, what does Coase say? And my way of putting it is that the first step is nothing works. The first step is in particular Pigou doesn't work. Because the whole analysis assumed that the reason for the cost was the pollution, the air pollution that my steel mill was putting out. But that's wrong. Because after all, if you didn't choose to live downwind from my steel mill, it'd be no problem. The reason for the problem is the combination of my putting air pollution there and your living there. Well, once you realize that these problems are almost always bicausal in that sense, you now say we don't know a priori who ought to adjust. When I was thinking of moving to this area about 19 years ago, and I used the internet, which existed 19 years ago, although not in as fancy a form as it does now, to do a bunch of real estate searching. And I found one house that really seemed amazingly underpriced. It was something, a really nice house with all sorts of things, much less expensive. And then I checked a little bit farther and discovered that where it was next to Mineta Airport. I don't know if it was called Mineta then, but next to the San Jose Airport. So what was going on was the value of that house was pushed way down by the fact that, you know, every 10 minutes there's an airplane flying over your roof, which is rather unpleasant. So one solution to that problem, that's a form of externality, is you're not allowed to have it fly airplanes. That's the extreme solution. Another is we can reduce it if the airplanes have to come in very high and then drop at the last stage of the flight plan. That way they're only making loud noises very close to the airplane. We can reduce it, perhaps, by modifying the airplanes to make them make less sound. All those things are costly. We could also reduce it by not having anybody live under the flight path. Right. We could also reduce it by having people under the flight path soundproof their houses. Those are all ways of reducing the cost, and the Pigouvian solution assumes that we know whose fault it is, so to speak. It's in a sense, judgmental in which the Coasean isn't. And so the Pigouvian solution takes it for granted that it's the airline's fault. Fine the airlines for the cost of their noise, and having done so, the airlines will then either raise fare prices to take account of that, or alternatively do things to reduce the noise pollution. Might be the right answer, might be the wrong answer, you don't know. It's worth noting, by the way, in passing, that in the legal context, there are two different ways you might apply the Pigouvian solution. One of them being a fine, and one of them being tort damages. And the reason that matters, in this case, the tort damages would say that if I have a house that's underneath the flight path, the airline owes its fine to me. Can people see why it matters which way we do it? Suppose we do it that way. What's going to be the effect of that going to be? No, but that doesn't depend on whether the fine goes to the house owner or the state. I'm saying, why does it matter whether it's a tort damage payment to the house owner or a fine to the state?
Yeah.
That is to say, if it goes to the state, then when you're deciding whether to build a house under there, you say, well, building a house under there, I'm going to have airplanes flying over the roof every 10 minutes. If the cost of building a house is larger than the value of a house with airplanes going over it, I better not do it. But if it's a tort damage, I say, well, yes, it's true that I'll have airplanes flying over my head every 10 minutes. But I'll also have a large income from those airplanes flying over my head and the tort damages they're going to owe me every 10 minutes. That may make it worth doing. All right, that may pay the cost of building my house. And a house for free, but no, I'm willing to live with that. All right. So one of the reasons why, although we usually think of both of those as Pigouvian taxes, they have different incentive effects because of who receives the money. That can sometimes matter. So that if you think about it in the context of highway accidents, if we say that when my car runs into you, I owe you damage payment, that means that I've got an incentive not to run into you, but you do not have an incentive to avoid being run into, or at least you have a lesser incentive to avoid being run into. And it's not only avoid being run into. A fair number of years ago, one of my colleagues and his wife came over for dinner, and they parked in our driveway. And at some point in the evening, for some reason, I had to go out. And I was not used to having a car parked in my driveway, and the result was that in pulling my car out, I dented his car. Right? Well, I agreed. He didn't have to sue me. I agree. I'm liable for repairs. Unfortunately, his car was a Mercedes. And I would have owed less if his car was a Ford. But when he decides whether to get a Mercedes or a Ford, there's no reason for him to take account of the fact that if someone else dents him, even if it's someone else's fault, he nonetheless, his decision to have a more expensive car makes my mistake more expensive for me. That's an external cost. So Coase's first point is that we've misconceived the problem. And one result is that a Pigouvian solution might make things worse rather than better. So suppose we have the Pigouvian solution, which is the fine on the airplanes. And suppose the result is that the airlines make very expensive modifications to their airplanes to make them quiet. And suppose we could have eliminated the problem at a tenth the cost by just moving everybody away from underneath the flight deck. In that case, if we hadn't had the Pigouvian solution, the airplanes would have made a lot of noise. Nobody would have built houses under the flight path. We'd have gotten the efficient solution. We have a Pigouvian solution to get the inefficient one. Yeah. A what? Which is? Be particularly vulnerable. Have a skull which will break one what would not normally break our skulls. You know? Yeah. And the argument against that is that the person who knows he has an eggshell skull is in a much better position to take precautions than the person who doesn't. This major distraction, but I teach a course in economic analysis of law. The person who is the largest figure in that field is Judge Posner. And Posner has this thesis, very interesting thesis, that you can make sense of the common law as a set of rules designed to maximize economic efficiency. And he has, I think, no good theoretical reason to expect that to be true, but he's got lots of what he at least would view as empirical evidence, because he and other people have gone through lots of the law saying what would be the efficient rule, and then Posner would claim in most cases saying, look, that is the common law rule. My standard example of what's wrong with this is that Posner, in his book, discusses two cases, which economically speaking are the identical case, happen to come under different parts of the law. In one of them, the eggshell skull case, the common law gives one answer. In one of them, which is the case where a photographer has spent a lot of money doing photography in the Himalayas, and he then sends his film into Walgreens and they lose it, which is just like the eggshell skull case. He had special information knowing that a mistake in his case would have a much larger cost than a mistake in the ordinary. And in that case, Walgreens is only liable for the ordinary value of film. Value. Posner discusses both of those cases to find decent economic efficiency. And it never occurs to him to be the same case. And the problem with that part of Posner's argument is that in many cases, the economics are complicated. So if you know what the common law rule is, you can figure out an argument for why it's the right rule. But if it was the other rule, as he demonstrates in that case, you would figure out an argument for that. I should say in an even larger digression, because it's from a book draft by a friend that I've just been reading, who's discussing the process of approving judges. And he's arguing that it's become very much more difficult over the last, since the Reagan administration, roughly. We've had a steady increase in how long it takes to get a federal judge approved, not only Supreme Court, circuit, less true at the district level. And the percentage that are turned down goes down. And furthermore, he argues that the process is, in fact, biased against good judges. That is, he argues that it is, that if you look at evidence such as whether a judge graduated from a top law school or whether he was on law review, or for judges who got appointed, if you look at the evidence later on how much people cited their cases, the better a judge is, the harder it is to get them. Slight oversimplification, right? He has statistical evidence, so I'm not sure it's right. And his explanation is that both sides of the political fight would rather not have judges that the other side appointed, but especially not have smart judges the other side appointed, because they'll be influential and they'll change things. And he cites various people, especially some of the Supreme Court fights, who are saying about some candidate, you know, we really have to fight him because he's right. And he's supporting the wrong ideas, so he'll make good arguments for the wrong ideas. It turns out that the ABA, he also has a discussion of the ABA. I should say, in general, his book is trying, with some success, to be even-handed in the sense of Lane's book of Public Democrats. Case of the ABA, he's not so good. Thinks that they've clearly got an agenda that they are trying to get left-of-center judges on and stop right-of-center judges. But one of his more striking pieces of evidence is that the three judges who have the highest rating in a couple of academic studies of the influence of judges are Posner, Easterbrook, and someone else I've never heard of. Easterbrook is second, and his rating is twice as high as that of Posner's third. All three of those got the lowest ABA rating when they were up initially to be appointed as circuit judges. And of course they were all Republican appointees. But anyway, that's a long digression. And it's not clear there's any solution to this problem. I mean, his basic argument is that the two things that have happened have been that judges have become more important, that over the last 40 years, the amount of important decisions that are being made by the courts, especially the Supreme Court, but also the circuit courts, less the district courts, have gotten larger and larger, and that American politics has gotten more polarized, and the more polarized you are, the more willing you are to say, yes, he's a brilliant thinker, that's a reason not to put him on the court, if he's on the other side, of course. He's just a weapon for the other side. So anyway, another digression, but I thought it was quite perfect. This is by an ex-student of mine, that's ex-student many years ago. Most of his stuff is not so unbiased, but he kind of knows which side he's on, but this one is interesting. Anyway, so let's go back to our airlines and go back to Mr. Posey's point. So Posey says, first step of my argument is nothing works. That in some cases, if you don't have a Pigouvian tax, you get the inefficient result. That's my steel mill air. In some cases, if you do have a Pigouvian tax, you get the inefficient result. In order to prevent that, the person who's putting on the tax would have to figure out which party ought to adjust. If the person putting on the tax knew that airlines can adjust more cheaply than people using the land underneath the flight path, then you put a Pigouvian tax on the airlines. If the person putting on the tax knew that the cheapest solution was to use land for something else, he says, we don't have a problem. No need for a Pigouvian tax. The airlines can make all the noise they like, and pretty soon there's going to be nothing but cows underneath them. All right? Or maybe noisy factories. But, of course, one of the advantages of the regulatory solution, as I just described, of the Pigouvian solution over the regulatory solution, was supposed to be that you didn't have to know the cost of controlling the problem. But you do have to know the cost of controlling the problem, at least well enough to know who's the lower cost avoider. And furthermore, there may be some cases where there is no lower cost avoider, because the optimal solution may be for one of the parties to do some things and the other party to do some things. All right? So maybe what you want is a little soundproofing and the houses really close to the airport shouldn't be there as houses, but farther out they should be. You can think of a variety of them. So therefore, its first step of the argument, as I say, is that nothing works. Second step of the argument is that everything works. And that's because he is now introducing bargaining between the parties. So he now says, all right, let us suppose that the cheap solution is to remove the houses, but the relevant regulators impose a Pigouvian fine on the airlines. Well, what do the airlines do? They get together and they buy the houses. They buy the houses, they sell them for grazing cattle on or noisy factories. Now it's going to cost them money to buy those houses, but it's going to be cheaper than paying the fine. And then they go back to the regulator and say, look down there. No houses, no external cost. Stop our Pigouvian fine. So that would be a solution. Similarly, suppose that what's going on is that it's a tort damage instead of a fine, the other version of the same solution. And now what happens? Again, assume that the cost to the airlines of stopping the damage is substantially lower than the cost to the homeowners of converting the land to some other use. Right? In that case, what do the airlines do? They go to the homeowners and say, look, buddy, at the moment, it's true you're getting $10,000 a year from us, but you're also having a whole lot of noise with airplanes going over you. In fact, that $10,000 just about cancels the noise. So you really would be no worse off if we bought your house for a sum to let you buy a house somewhere else. A little bit better if we sweetened the deal by throwing in a little extra money. But the cost to us of doing that would be less than the cost of keeping on paying you for these fines, so therefore it'll pay us more. So the basic Coase doesn't use the airline example here. Although he uses lots of other examples, mostly from real legal cases. But the basic lesson here is that as long as the law says who has what rights, whether the airline does or doesn't have the right to make the noise, in effect, that then private transactions in the interest of the parties involved can solve the problem if those transactions. So that's the part of Coase's argument which gets referred to as the Coase theorem, not Coase's term, probably Stigler's term. And the trouble with that, as with my earlier comment about thinking you understand relativity, is that a lot of people say, well, I can state the Coase theorem, therefore I understand the Coase theorem. But the Coase theorem is really just a little bit in the middle of the argument, because Coase doesn't claim there are no transaction costs. What Coase is really saying is the reason the problem exists isn't simply the fact of the external cost. It's that there is a situation where there's a cost jointly produced, and there are transaction costs that prevent the parties involved from solving that problem. Right? That's really, so the third step is to say it's all transaction costs. All right? And you then say, well, what kind of transaction costs are we looking at? Well, one obvious example would be what I give in the article, air pollution in Southern California. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Southern California. It's a foreign country. You're going to probably need a visa if you want to go down there, given you live in Northern California. But I've actually been. I was a resident alien there for a while. But anyway, Southern California has had this problem with air pollution in Los Angeles for quite a long time. And let us suppose for a moment that the legal rule was that the drivers of cars have no liability for air pollution. If it's true that putting on catalytic converters would greatly reduce the air pollution, it is then likely that the benefit to people living in Los Angeles of everybody putting on catalytic converters would be much higher than the cost of doing so. So why wouldn't the residents of Los Angeles pay the drivers in Los Angeles, who are mostly the same people anyway, to put on the catalytic converters? Well, start out with standard market failure problem. Each individual says, if I put on the catalytic converter, that gives me a 1 cent advantage and the rest of the cost is the benefit to everybody else, and I pay all the costs. I'm not going to do that. That's bargained it out. How do we go about arranging a contract among 4 million people in which each of them says, well, you know, if I don't sign the contract and you guys do, I get clean air and I don't have to put on a catalytic converter. It's a great deal. If I do sign and most other people don't, I don't get anything because we're not going to go through. So why should I sign? Right? So it's a problem of a transaction cost. And you can imagine other transaction costs in other contexts. Might say, well, an easier case is the two-party case. Let's imagine that there's the factory, and there's only one person down there. And then the problem is that even for that bargaining, if, suppose the initial, let me go back a step. The Coase theorem says whatever the starting legal rule, as long as it defines who has what rights, if there were no transaction costs, the parties would always bargain for the efficient outcome. Right? But what does bargaining for the efficient outcome mean? It means gains larger than losses, so we've got to divide the gains up right, everybody can get some of it, and therefore it's all right. So suppose the legal, let's make it a noisy factory. And suppose the legal rule is that since you live next to my noisy factory, I am not allowed to make noise without your permission. Well, let's further suppose that the cost to me of not making noise is $1 million. And the value to me if you're not making noise is $10,000. We now have what economists and game theorists call a bilateral monopoly bargain. A bargain where each party has a monopoly. You're the only person who can make that stop, that noise stop, and I'm the only person who can give you permission to do it. You're the only person who wants permission to make noise in that factory, and I'm the only person selling some permission. So that's why it's a monopoly in both directions. There's a big bargaining range, because you will, if you have to, pay any price lower than $1 million. I will, if I can, if I have to, accept any price more than $10,000. With that big bargaining range, we're likely to spend a lot of time and effort, each of us trying to push the agreement in his direction. One way of doing it is to misrepresent the costs and benefits, so that you might, it might be that you say, well, actually, it might be that it really is only going to cost you $15,000 to prevent it, but you're going to claim it costs you $1 million. It might be that I will overstate the cost. To me, you can think of lots of different ways in which the bargaining might go wrong. And some of those result in bargaining breakdown where I don't give you the permission because I'm trying to hold out for a higher sum, and you don't agree to the higher sum because that sum is more than you're willing to pay. So maybe even more than the cost to you or shutting down the bank. So you can imagine transaction costs not only in the many player case, but in the small number of player cases, maybe clearer in the many player cases. So all of that helps explain why the problem exists, and what Coase is saying is not the problem doesn't exist, but it's been misunderstood. Now, there are lots and lots of cases. Let me sort of run through, just for the interest, some of the Coasean cases, many of which have the useful feature that it's not obvious to our moral intuition who's the bad guy. That in a sense, that one way of looking at the Pigouvian mistake was that when you put it in the language of externalities, you said, all right, we know that A is stepping on B's toes. But there are lots of cases where it's not clear whether B's toes ought to be there or not. All right? So let me start with one of the real cases. It's British, I think, probably 19th century, maybe 18th or 19th century case, where you've got a man who's operating a confectionery factory with a big powered mortar that pounded sugar into it. Pounded sugar into my candy. And his neighbor is a physician. No problem. The physician decides that he would like to have a consulting room added to his house so he can do some of his work at home. And he builds the consulting room up against the common wall, up against the property line, so it's right against the wall of the factory. He now discovers that he cannot listen to a stethoscope, the thing that goes into your ears. You can't listen to the stethoscope because the vibration from the factory is creating too much noise and disturbance. So he can't use his consulting room for a consulting room. So he sues to make the factory shut down its operations. Right? Well, is it clear who's at fault? I mean, he would say, well, look, you've got perfect right to vibrate your side of the property line, but you're vibrating my side of the property line. You're shaking my house, so you shouldn't do that. You've got to stop. Whereas, obviously, the candy maker, aside from saying candy is virtuous and good, and therefore you should stop my making it, is also going to say, I've been doing this for 15 years, you never complained before, it's the reason this problem occurred is that you built that silly room there instead of building it inside. Right. Real case, I don't remember how it turned out, but it's a nice example. And again, what Coase says is, as long as there are reasonable people who've been bargaining for their common benefit, if the court says that the candy maker has to stop vibrating the wall, the candy maker goes to the doctor and says, look, I'll pay the cost of rebuilding your consulting room on the other side of the side, because that's much cheaper than rebuilding, than moving my factory, and therefore they get a arrangement, and they pay you a little extra. Whereas if the court says the candy maker has the right, then if it's really cheaper to move the candy maker's factory, the doctor says, look, I'll pay the cost of breaking down this common wall, moving the wall in 5 feet, which will be enough so it doesn't transmit to my side, and then that'll stop. So that sort of is an example. Which way it went, I don't know. Florida cases. And these are interesting because somebody actually told me that what was really going on was not what the article implies going on. But the Florida case is that Hotel A is sitting here with a beautiful swimming pool, and Hotel B is built next to it shading the pool. But the question is, does Hotel A have a property right to the sunlight falling on its pool? Right, that's one way of thinking. And I don't remember what the court finally decided, but you can see that it's not immediately obvious that on the one hand, they can say, part of the value of this land is that it's got Florida, after all, it's got sunlight on it. That's why people come to our hotel, and you have just reduced the value of our land. That's an externality. You should either owe us damages or pay a fine or something. Or the other guy says, you own your land. I own my land. You never paid the sun to shine on you. Those sun rays are trespassing across my land on the way to your swimming pool, and if I want to block it, tough luck for you. Same kind of problem. And again, you can see that whichever way the rule goes, if it's really cheaper to have the outcome go the other way and if bargaining costs are low, you're all right. Now, I should say, somebody told me, I don't remember who or whether he's really well informed, that the truth of this case was it was a grudge fight. That the second hotel was built by someone who didn't like the owner of the first hotel and accordingly was deliberately shaded. It was great that the bargaining might have been harder. And that reminded me of a story that has only a very dubious connection to this, but it's still a good story. That is that one result of the U.S. winning World War II was that the U.S. occupying government broke up the Zaibatsu, which were groups of firms operating jointly in Japan, which had bought others in some sense, and monopolies of things. And prior to the war, the most famous hotel in Tokyo was a hotel designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, which was the only large building, I think, that survived the Tokyo pre-war. And the owner of that hotel, I think it was the Tokyo hotel, lost control of it as a result of the breaking up of the Zaibatsu. So he was rather unhappy with it. So he built another hotel, the Okura Hotel, which became the best hotel in Tokyo. And the Okura Hotel, on its top floor, had a men's room and a woman's room with plate glass windows looking out on the American embassy. So that was his sort of symbolic revenge. Which presumably imposed no cost to the embassy. In any case, going back then, the other cases that he mentions, one of them is... In fact, there are two cases which are interesting because they seem to parallel each other, but turns out they've got opposite court results. One of the questions is why. And one of them is a movement of air relevant to a chimney drain. If you have somebody who has a building, and the building has fireplaces in it, the smoke comes out of the fireplaces, and the building next door builds up a little higher and puts some things on top of the building, with the result that the wind can't blow through there anymore. Now higher than the top of the first building, and the result is the chimney no longer draws, and so the rooms get full of smoke, and so they try to sue. And the question is, do you own a property right to the wind blowing across your roof? The answer not clear. The other case was one that involved a brewery where the brewery was, I think the basement of the brewery was connected by, I think it was an ancient mines, maybe prehistoric mines. There was a passage through that came up under someone else's courtyard. And the result was that the effluvium from the brewing came up in his courtyard. And he stopped up the outlet to stop that from happening, and then the brewery claimed that they could sue, that they had the right to stop it in this way, and that they had no right. I think they won. I think they won on theory, on some odd theory of ancient right, which is basically, it's sort of like adverse possession, but not exactly, but it's a theory under which the fact that they had been doing it for a long time with nobody objecting implied they must have had a legal right to do it, even though they no longer had not. So it's a theory. I think that was a theory, if I remember correctly. And so the logic in both cases, you've got air moving, in one case over a building, in one case through a tunnel, essentially, and in one case the claim is you do have a right to have the air move the way it used to move in the case of the brewery. Now, maybe this is just because the English have a soft spot in their heart for breweries and candy makers, I don't know, but in the other cases. So, but all of these all raise the same kind of issues. Let me go back to make a different point, which has been sometimes been offered as a critique of Coase, but I think it's not actually a critique, although it's a true statement. And that is that Coase's claim is that however you define the initial rights, you end up with an efficient outcome. And that may, with zero transaction. However, in some cases, it's a different efficient outcome. And let me give you my favorite example. Imagine a world with only two people in it. And we have, let us say, fairly similar wealth. But there is one extra object. The extra object is a life expectancy. There's only one of them. Felt from space or something. But whoever takes it, it'll double his life expectancy. If the starting point is that belongs to me, you will not be able to make me any offer for which I'm going to sell it. So it ends up in my hands, zero transaction benefit. If it starts out one view, I will not be able to make any offer for which it sells. So that means that who has the initial property right does indeed affect the outcome, who gets the pill. How can it be that both of these outcomes are efficient? Because economic efficiency is measuring value by willingness to pay. In the world where I start with the pill, I'm much richer than you are because I've got this very valuable item. Consequently, the amount that I will accept for the pill is much higher than the amount you are in a position to pay. So therefore, measuring value to me and value to you by willingness to pay and willingness to accept is more value. And if it started out with you, we get the opposite result. So in that case, the outcome is efficient in both cases. This reflects the fact that efficiency is weighting utility by wealth, in effect, by value of view of money. But they're different outcomes. And the reason this doesn't show up in Coase's example is that in Coase's example, the goods produced are not being produced for the consumption of the goods. They're being produced for the market. So in Coase's example, you're growing grain to sell, you're growing cattle to sell. So it's true that a rule that says that we have closed range and therefore the rancher must fence in his cattle, that rule makes the rancher poorer and the farmer richer. It means that if the rancher, let me go back, I think I discussed it in the article. But the basic issue is you've got a rancher and you've got a farmer, and if you don't have a fence holding in the rancher's cattle, they'll stray into the farming fields and down the street. And so one solution is to fence in, which is that the rancher is legally obliged to keep his cattle from straying and always damages if he doesn't. And the other is fence out, which is the rule that says the rancher is free to let his cattle wander as they like, and if the farmer doesn't like it, the farmer's got to go to fence it. Coase, in running through in great detail this case, says, look, whichever rule it has, we're going to say that. Because if the cost to the farmer of fencing out is lower than the cost to the rancher of fencing in, then even if the rancher is legally obliged to fence in, the rancher will pay the farmer for permission not to pay the farmer to build the fence. Instead, and vice versa, you're going to run through the same argument. But now, what is true, however, is that if the rancher has the right, open range, then if the farmer wants the rancher to fence his, to keep his cattle in, the farmer has to pay the rancher. If the farmer has the right, then if the rancher wants the farmer to fence out, the rancher has to pay the farmer. So that means that the two different rules result in a different distribution of wealth between the two people. So it's all of the saying, you know, what do you owe? You owe rights. You think of owing things, but you really owe rights with regard to things, and they have different rights with regard to what they're doing. But
since the making the one of the two richer and the other poorer isn't going to affect the market demand for wheat cattle. That's outside the other people, and therefore isn't going to affect what's the efficient way to behave. I should say, I'm simplifying Coase as a example. He's also considering not only altering through fences, but also altering the size of the herd. So he's imagining that the rancher is deciding whether to add one more animal to his herd. The more animals he has in his herd, the greater the damage they'll do for the wheat field if nobody fences. So he has to include that external cost. But even if he's not liable for the cost, the farmer is going to suffer it, so the farmer will pay him to keep his herd down, essentially. So he's running through. That's equivalent to my smokestack, really, saying one of the things you can do is to vary how much of the problem. But ultimately, that trade-off depends on the value of wheat and the value of cattle. Changing the rights between the farmer and the rancher won't affect the value of wheat and value of cattle. Therefore, in Coase's example, you get the same efficient outcome. The only difference is who has to pay it. Whereas, as we pointed out, there are other cases where it really does matter and that it affects. But they're all efficient. It's just different efficient outcomes. And Coase agree. I mean, it's not like Coase disagrees at that point. Let me run through a bunch of things I could run through, but let me mention one of them, and that is that there's another situation where the Pigouvian solution makes things worse, and that's the one that I think of as Coase plus Pigouvian. So imagine that I have a factory. My factory is doing air pollution, and the air pollution that I am doing does $100,000 worth of damage to the people down there. But it would cost me $120,000 to prevent it. Right? So the government has a Pigouvian fine, and I pay $100,000 a year to the government. I'm doing that, but the alternative is even more expensive if you do it. However, the people downwind are still getting polluted. So what do the people downwind do? They say, well, you know, we're suffering. There are only three of them that happen. Like the big estates, or maybe their vacation resorts or something. And they get and say, you know, another $20,000 and he'd be willing to stop polluting. So we're going to get together and offer him $30,000. And if we offer him $30,000, if he doesn't pollute, he says to himself, well, if I stop polluting, I save $100,000 that I'm paying the government as a fine. I get $30,000 underneath, guys. That $130,000 is more than $120,000 of preventing my pollution, so I'll do it. But he's making an inefficient decision because he's doing something where the actual benefit's $100,000, the actual cost. All right? That's what I think of as Coase plus Pigouvian is too much for this thing. Because the result is he's getting a double incentive. He's getting one incentive from the fine, one incentive Now, that's a case where if you made it a tort damage instead, the problem would go away because now the money he's paying would be going to the landowners, and therefore they would realize that if they paid him to stop polluting, they'd also stop getting $100,000 a year, and that would make them run out of money. So earlier I was discussing a case where you had a bad effect for making a tort instead of fine. Here's one that had a good effect. So it's fine. Hopefully this way you can stop it more complicated than let me think for other things that are worth mentioning in this context before going on to other stuff. If you're sufficiently curious, something I'll be talking about a little bit next time before we go on to other things. I may also take a look at the reading for next week. I'm not sure that we really have another day to talk about it. Most people raise some questions. But one thing is, if you took Coase's point of view and tried to design a legal system, which is in a sense what we're doing with regard to the particular set of issues in IP law, what is it? How does it work? And if you only took the first two steps, you would say we don't really care. All rules work. But once you take the third step and say, wait a minute, we now want to say, imagine all ways we might initially allocate. Imagine always the rights that might actually get used. From each allocation, how do we get to each of the possible outcomes? The example that I worked through in excruciating detail in my Law's Order book, which is where people look at it, I'm considering the case of railroads that are throwing sparks that are starting fires. So that was actually a good example. I should say, actually, a different digression. One of the other points Post makes that was something was wrong with Seguin was that Seguin was assuming that there was some unambiguous starting point. So Seguin is saying that because the railroads can throw sparks that start fires and aren't liable for them, therefore the railroads will have an insufficient incentive to avoid throwing sparks. So he says, wait a minute, when is this story happening? He actually looks at the relevant English list. And he points out that the default English rule was that the railroads were liable. And the only reason they weren't liable was that it was between some date and some other date, and I forget what it was. And if the railroad had been built by an act of parliament, then the act of parliament would have said the railroad was immune from liability for the throwing sparks. So that whereas Pigou was, as it were, saying the laissez-faire situation, the situation without government intervention is, and that has an externality problem. Posting there is no laissez-faire in that sense. You've got a legal system. The legal system could make them liable. It could not make them liable. And you can look at the effects of either way of doing it. It isn't as if one of them is sort of the state of nature and the other is the result of it. All right. I think we're out of time. Hopefully this recording has worked.